supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In 2011, Philadelphia cable giant Comcast launched an internet service for low-income students and families. Dubbed Internet Essentials, the program delivers home broadband for $10 a month. And today, Comcast executive David Cohen announced low-income veterans will now be eligible for the service.
There's about 70% do not have internet access at home, and that's the gap that we're going to try to address here.
Comcast also published new data today showing that Internet Essentials grew by 50% last year alone. There are now 6 million users across the country, nearly 200,000 in Philadelphia. Joining me to discuss Internet Essentials and its impact is Michaela Winberg, reporter for Billy Penn. Michaela, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We'll talk to the specifics of this new announcement, but why don't we do a little bit of historical retrospective? The Comcast program started, I believe, 7 years ago.
Sure, yeah, in 2011.
And it was then Mayor John Street, some 15 years ago, that envisioned free internet for those who were in need.
Right, yeah. Mayor John Street, it was in 2004 that he thought up this idea. He called it Wireless Philadelphia. It was this plan to get sort of municipal broadband access either free or really affordable for people who couldn't afford it. Unfortunately for Mayor Street, he did not have a ton of support on that idea, so it sort of flopped before it ever really got off the ground. I think the reason John Street got the most flack for it was because he's trying to start this municipal internet idea in a city where Comcast is headquartered. So Philadelphia is known for a huge internet provider being here, and so to start municipal internet, it was kind of like a slap in the face.
So, in retrospect, perhaps had Street gone to Comcast initially, it might have seen more success.
Right, yeah. There were New York Times stories from at the time that sort of thought that up as an idea. Like, why didn't you partner with them or pair up with them in some way? But that was not how it went. So it sort of, John Street ended up selling the idea to Earthlink, which, you know.
Some of us recall.
Right, yeah. So that didn't really take off either. So it sort of all just flopped.
Frankly, was the inception of Internet Essentials based in part on them kind of putting up a stop sign to the Mayor Street plan?
At the time, there was definitely some advocacy work in the state legislature on behalf of Comcast and Verizon. They both sort of worked together to help torpedo the program.
So what did Comcast come up with 7 years back?
Yeah, so 7 years ago, Comcast pioneered a program called Internet Essentials, and back then it was for certain groups of people who were experiencing economic hardship. They would get internet for $10 a month, so long as they qualify, and also they would have access to computers for around $150, a discounted price for most people. So that was the idea way back in the day, and it has grown in terms of people who have access. Exactly, eligibility qualifications. In terms of families, if you have one child who gets access to free lunch, you can qualify. If you receive housing assistance, if you're in community college, all of those things will help you qualify for the program.
How many are enrolled in the program in our area currently?
Mm-hmm. In the Philadelphia area, there are 196,000 people enrolled, and that's up 63% from just a year ago. So, yeah, last year it was like 124,000 people were enrolled, and that went up to 196,000. So it does increase sizably, you know, over the years, it looks like.
So back to John Street's failed experiment.
Mm-hmm.
For those municipalities that don't have Comcast as their corporate anchor, were any of them more successful at launching
free internet? Sure, yeah. There are a few towns in America where it did work. So Chattanooga, Tennessee has municipal internet, Santa Monica, California, Fort Collins, Colorado, and I'm sure there are more, but those are, you know, a few that we came across in our research at Billy Penn where they pioneered a program like that and it actually worked.
Of course, this is in the context of your organization, Billy Penn, and ours, WHYY, being among 19 interests who form Broken Philly.
Yes,
looking
right.
At issues attending to economic justice.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Obviously, in 2018, it's pretty essential to have internet service, yet apparently many go without, both in the region and across the country.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's difficult to afford, and I think anyone could understand that. Anyone who pays a regular internet bill, you know, it can be expensive. It can, you know, reach $50. If you add cable, it can get even more than that. And that's a really tough bill to meet for people who are experiencing economic hardship. The one woman who I spoke to, her name is Alexis Flone, and she lives in West Philly. She is a student at Delaware County Community College, and she said she needs internet to do her homework naturally. And she works two part-time jobs, and she tries to make ends meet, but it's not easy. And $10 a month for an internet bill, that makes a huge difference.
Do other competitors, internet services, have similar plans?
Yeah, certainly. AT&T and Verizon both have plans like this where they offer either discounted or reduced rates for internet bills. It's not, you know, specifically unique to Comcast, although Comcast does offer a pretty solid option.
I mean, yes, this is wonderful, but is it to imagine that Comcast is this just wonderful corporate citizen and community representative? Or are they doing it for part of their profit motive, too?
I'm sure there's PR intentions in it. I'm sure that Comcast knows that as a corporation, they're both doing something good for people and also doing something good for their image.
Michaela, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Philly Penn reporter Michaela Winberg. For the last 4 years, a major nonprofit in Philadelphia has been offering homeless young adults something most people in their shoes don't have access to. It's called permanent supportive housing, one of the most expensive, full-service models out there for helping homeless people get off the streets. WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports that the program appears to be paying off.
This is it. Yep. This is the spot.
Jerome Maynard is showing me his new two-bedroom apartment in Roxborough. He's 26 and moved in a couple months ago with his girlfriend and a sprightly rescue dog named Cauliflower, a Chihuahua mix.
Relax. Come here. It's okay.
The place is roomy, but nothing fancy. Beige carpeting, white walls, a modern kitchen with a dishwasher. But it's Maynard's, and that's a big deal. Until about a year ago, he was homeless and had been for a while.
I mean, I'm still getting used to it, but it does feel nice.
Maynard is here thanks to Project Home's Young Adult Program, which offers 18 to 23-year-olds what's known as permanent supportive housing. It's a model that most places almost exclusively use to help older, chronically homeless adults and families considered most at risk. Project Home's young adult program costs about $500,000 a year, including government subsidies. Kate Gormley leads the program. She says it's money well spent to prevent chronic homelessness.
What my program seeks to do is interrupt cycles of poverty, cycles of trauma, cycles of displacement, so that the 22-year-old that we're serving right now will not be the 32-year-old living in one of our buildings.
And unlike other housing programs for the homeless, which can max out after a year or two, residents can hang on to their subsidized apartments as long as they need to, if they can kick in enough for rent. Gormley says that means people don't leave until they're actually ready to, potentially reducing the risk they'll end up on the streets again.
So some people leave because they're no longer low income and they don't need us anymore. Sometimes people leave because they're in a serious relationship and they want to move in with their partner. And then, you know, some people need the structure of the program when they first come in and then find some kind of stability and then decide a little bit later, like, hey, you know, I got what I came for. I can do this on my own now. I'm gonna go try that.
In addition to housing, the program teaches residents skills they need to live independently, like how to cook a meal for themselves. There's also help if people want to get their GED or apply to college, and mental and physical health services. This is the supportive part of permanent supportive housing.
And it's not a cookie-cutter program where everyone does the same thing. It's, you know, we really do look at the individual and their needs and what their trajectory can be.
Maynard's goal was to save enough money for college so he could pursue his dream of becoming a sports broadcaster, a dream that was deferred after his life was flipped upside down at 18. A few months before he was supposed to start classes at Penn State Abington, Maynard's aunt kicked him out of her Northeast Philly home. The reason? Maynard's first and only brush with the law.
I stopped in at Macy's because I had to use the bathroom, and while I was using the bathroom, a few of my friends was stealing out of the store. And because they were stealing out of the store and we were all together. As we left the store, the security guard stopped all of us and basically we was all accused of stealing, and basically I was kind of guilty by association.
Maynard was placed in a holding cell and charged with retail theft. He was eventually found not guilty, but his arrest was the last straw in an already strained relationship with his aunt. Shortly after he was released, she dropped him off at Covenant House, a shelter for homeless youth in Germantown. He lost contact with other members of his family.
So it was just pretty much just me.
4 years ago, after the clock ran out on his time at Covenant House, Maynard landed a spot at JBJ Soul Homes in Fairmount, one of three Project Home sites with permanent supportive housing for young adults. Maynard says knowing he could stay there as long as he needed was reassuring. It gave him hope, and it also motivated him.
It still pushed me to continue to push myself and stay driven, because you can fall into a level of complacency. I tried to avoid that as much as I could.
Maynard says the staff at JBJ pushed him too, reminding him he could change his life. And after working a few different jobs, Maynard was eventually able to save enough money to get back to his dream of going to college. He moved out of JBJ a year ago. Now, while taking classes, Maynard works two jobs, including a supervisor position at a homeless shelter. Matthew Morton leads a research initiative focused on youth homelessness based at the University of Chicago. He says experiences like Maynard's help make the case for having more high-quality permanent supportive housing programs for young adults. Morton's research has found that in the 12 communities he's studied, only about 6% of young people who enter their local homeless system are placed into permanent supportive housing.
Supportive housing programs can be relatively expensive, we need to keep these costs in perspective. When young people with high risk and vulnerability are offered nothing but minimal support or just emergency shelters, we know that they have very little chance of exiting homelessness on their own.
Maynard says the same data has revealed the opposite may be true for the few who do get placed in a good permanent supportive housing program.
Our research shows that the vast majority of young people who are placed into supportive housing programs, in fact, about 9 out of 10 of them, do not reenter the local homelessness system within a year or more of starting those programs.
It's just one of the reasons Kate Gormley believes so strongly in her growing program.
I'm a mom, so I always worry. That's just kind of happening in the background. But I would say that our guys, at the end of the day, you know what skills they have and what you've offered them, and you've watched them grow over the years. So I have a lot of confidence that when folks leave our program, that they're ready to take on independence.
Since 2014, Project Home's young adult program has served more than 60 people. So far, 8 have moved out on their own. None of them have returned to the streets. Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
In the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania, a new campaign ad features incumbent U.S. Senator Bob Casey attacking his opponent, Republican Congressman Lou Barletta, for his vote 7 years ago to restructure Medicare. Opponents of the bill claimed it would open the door to privatizing health care for seniors. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that Barletta's campaign says the ad is repeating a proven lie.
Senior citizens have the highest turnout rate of any voter age group, and Casey's ad goes after Barletta for a vote in 2011.
In Congress, Lou Barletta supported a plan that would have ended Medicare as we know it, turning it into a voucher system run by private insurance companies.
It's true the plan by then-House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan would have given future retirees government allotments to buy private insurance. The on-screen text of the ad says Barletta voted to end Medicare. Barletta spokesman Matt Bynum says the Truth Squad PolitiFact found that was a whopper.
PolitiFact, I mean, independent fact checkers called this the lie of the year of 2011.
He's right. PolitiFact found the Ryan plan would maintain some government support for senior health care, so saying it would end Medicare goes too far. But while the on-screen text in the Casey ad is problematic, the voiceover qualifies the attack, saying the plan would end Medicare as we know it. PolitiFact editor Angie Holden says the group did not call that claim a lie.
PolitiFact actually decided not to rate the claim that the Ryan plan ends Medicare as we know it because we thought saying it ends Medicare as we know it was ultimately a subjective opinion.
So the voiceover of the Casey ad passes muster with PolitiFact. The on-screen text doesn't. Underlying the scrap is a genuine policy difference. Barletta's more inclined to trust competition among private providers to lower costs and serve seniors. Casey likes the direct single-payer structure of the current Medicare system. The Ryan plan never made it through Congress. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
This morning's heavy rainfall brought some parts of the Philadelphia area to a halt. Roads were shut down due to flooding. Businesses sustained severe damage in flood-prone areas. WHYY's Darrell C. Murphy has the story from Upper Darby.
Water flooded Upper Darby this morning on Marshall Road, where George's Water Ice Shop is located. Inside the store was submerged in over 2 feet of water. A freezer filled with ice cream was flipped over. Food supplies were soaked with filthy water, and a snake found its way into the shop. Manager DaCosta Vroom estimates it'll be weeks before reopening.
It's been it's quite a disturbing situation.
There were no serious casualties, though a police officer suffered minor injuries after falling down a manhole during one of two reported rescue missions. Sergeant Brian Vaughn was one of the officers at the scene of the flood.
See, what happens is when it floods, the manhole covers will pop up. So you could be walking along and go straight down.
Upper Darby Mayor Tom McCosey says flooding occurs often in that area, blaming an overburdened underground drainage system.
But whenever we have heavy rains north of us, we can experience, as it's moving east, that there's just nowhere for the water to go.
Since many residents don't use trash cans, the bags get swept up in the flood water along with other debris and clogs the system that runs into Cobbs Creek. But once the system is unplugged,
the water rescinds just like a bathtub.
The flood began around 10 a.m., and by 1 p.m., the road was clear for traffic. For WHYY, Darrell C. Murphy.
Philadelphia native and astronaut Chris Ferguson is preparing to go aloft next year, part of the first commercial craft test flights. Let's celebrate with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, this is yet another accomplishment for the Archbishop Ryan High School and Drexel University grad. He currently works for Boeing, and is Boeing the commercial entity that's sending him aloft?
Yes, that's true. He is going under the auspices of Boeing as a Boeing employee, but as Boeing under contract to NASA to build this spacecraft that's going to provide astronaut access from the U.S. up to International Space Station and beyond.
Presumably, it won't be departing from Philly International.
No, it won't be departing from Philly International. It will be departing from Cape Canaveral, Florida. But in this particular instance, this spacecraft will be akin to the SpaceX version of the commercial era spacecraft that will be launching around the same time.
Will international astronauts also participate?
Right. So the way this is going to work is that NASA is going to continue its service of International Space Station with astronauts from across the world that are partners in the space station program.
So more appropriate to think of this as an ongoing way for ISS to sustain.
Yeah, you can in fact think of it as the quote-unquote replacement for a space shuttle, but we have to clarify it in that the CST-100 Starliner really is a crew taxi vehicle to take crew astronauts from the surface of the Earth up to low Earth orbit, including International Space Station.
Derek, last week we alerted listeners to the now ongoing Perseid meteor shower. Harder to pinpoint on the calendar, but there's a new sunspot cycle about to start.
Oh, this is much more difficult to pinpoint than the Perseid meteor shower. We have a general idea and understanding of the length of these solar cycles. And the solar cycle is that period of time across which the sun seems to go from a minimum number of sunspots and solar activity up to a maximum, and then back down to a minimum again. And the typical number used for this, or average, is about 11 years. Except in specific instances in history where there were great long periods when there weren't any sunspots seen, one of which is known as the Maunder Minimum, from 1645 to 1715. This was a time when there were so few sunspots, and in fact, that change in the sun's activity level definitely affected the Earth and caused a period of time in Europe known as the Little Ice Age.
There's a broader lesson for those of us enjoying looking aloft. You can't always set your watch or calendar to when a certain astronomical vision will take place.
Yeah, that's quite true, Dave. In fact, if we're talking about something like a solar eclipse, any kind of eclipse, things like that are really precise timings and specific to particular locations on the Earth. But most other events take place over a much longer period of time. So we really don't have to panic too much when we hear about a particular event that's going to take place. Even in eclipses, for example, yes, you want to be able to see totality either in the solar eclipse or the lunar eclipse, but both events take place over many hours during the course of the day, 4 to 6 hours. So you can catch some of it in that period of time. Another example of this is the close approach of Mars. If you, for example, may have missed the date of close approach of Mars, which was just a week or so ago, well, I'm here to help you feel a little bit better about that, because if you go out and take a look at Mars now, it will still appear bright and a bit larger than it might have appeared if you looked at it a year ago, but you probably won't be able to tell the difference anyway in size unless you measured it, or if you were a true Mars aficionado and observed it every time it was visible. So for the casual observer, just enjoy the long periods of time that we have to view.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.